We'd Like a Word.
About spreading the word about your book. You're listening to We'd Like a Word with me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colgan.
I like surprising Steve. Usually I go to him when he's eating a biscuit, so that's my favourite type of surprise. So he splutters all over
week,
the place.
I've stayed away from the biscuits until we're in full flow.
Yeah, the Jammy Dodgers haven't been touched yet, but they will soon. And my surprise for him today is Angela McMahon, who's in the studio with us.
Good God, where did you come from?
Book publicist extraordinaire, co-director of the New Ireland Festival, which is fantastic. We'll talk about that later. Director of Flow Communications. And the reason it's a surprise is because I just bumped into you last night.
Yes.
When you were doing your job. And tell us what you were doing.
I am currently working with the wonderful Anne Cleaves, best-selling author of the Vera and Shetland novels. And we were having a launch party at Hatchard's in Piccadilly last night. And I invited Paul along.
And I came because it was free drink.
Yes.
And also I like Anne.
Anne is lovely. Yes.
And tell us about her book.
Her new book is set in North Devon. It is the first in a brand new series, the Two Rivers series, and has a host of new characters, a beautiful new setting, and it's everything that you would expect from an Anne Cleaves novel. Incredible setting, very atmospheric. You can practically taste the salt on the air in the books.
And what's it called?
And it is called, good point, The Long Call.
See, I was thinking, she's forgotten what
I know. Well, it's not used to being on this side of the mic. Yeah. I'm usually behind someone kind of going, and remember the title of the book?
Yeah, I've read the book.
Yes.
And it's really, really good. And I've read some of her other books. I haven't read all of them. My mum really likes her. Mm-hmm. And my mum and a friend of hers. And I went to see her at the New Ireland Festival,
indeed,
which was really good. But I've read this particular one. And the thing I like most about it is the relationship between the detective, Matthew Venn, and his partner. And I don't want to say more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just lovely kind of domestic intimacy and relationships.
Well,
and I thought
that's
hard to achieve.
That's us West Country people, see, we're like that. We're warm.
Yeah,
it's very comfortable, I think. That's the thing. I think the characters that Anne peoples her books with just feel very alive and just very human in many ways, you know, just normal people that you would expect to meet in the course of, you know, your normal everyday life, bumping into all sorts of diverse, different people, but very, very normal.
I should say also that she introduced you when she was making her little talk, saying, I've only met Angela about 3 weeks ago, and already she's put me everywhere. I'm on every radio station, everything. And so she obviously thinks you're very good at what you do. But and she's really nice. What do you do if you're working with somebody who you think is really rubbish? Or you don't like them?
Oh, that's a tricky one.
Ooh, that is a tricky one.
I'm going to have a jammy dodge.
I know.
I used to be a policeman, and sometimes I had to guard people I didn't like. And that's a tricky one.
Yeah. And I think, to be honest, I think we've all worked in various professions, and you know, all sorts of different people have to work with people that they don't necessarily like, but you go into professional mode and you just get on with it. It's not, you know, you're not there to be best friends with them. I mean, if you're lucky, and if as a publicist I've met incredible people who I like hugely and have become very good friends with, but that's not my job. My job is actually to help publicise their book. Sometimes you end up working on books that you don't like very much.
Do you have a little code? I mean, what I'm thinking of, sometimes, going back to a different job I did, reporting in Belfast, you know, if somebody was shot dead, a person would be on TV saying, nobody deserves to be shot dead in the street like this. And then somebody might whisper in their ear and they'd say, nobody deserves to be shot down in the street like this, no matter who they are.
Right,
okay. So I don't. Do you have any little code? You'd be thinking, "Oh, this is really brilliant," and then you kind of wink at people, going,
"This is a really good book if you like that sort of thing."
I think you know.
You're too professional.
Of course she is.
You know, when I worked, so I now work for myself. I set up a business 3 years ago. In fact, it's my third anniversary on Sunday.
Congratulations!
Happy birthday!
Thank you very much. But prior to that, I've worked in a couple of different publishers. And, you know, when you are a publicist working for a, you know, a normal company, you're just given books. You don't get to choose what you want to work on. And most of the time, the reason that the books are published is because they're, you know, they're quite good books and they're reasonably well written. But there's also a market for it. So it's not about necessarily your personal taste, but it's actually recognising that there is a market and you want to put those people in touch with the book that they're potentially going to read. So I think, you know, I would say for me, the first rule is actually understanding the market. And, you know, as a, you know, we'll probably touch on that later on anyway, but I'm not there to judge either the author or the book. It's just to understand that it has been published for a good reason. I might not, you know, it might not be my taste. You know, occasionally there are books that I've been asked to work on where I kind of maybe not so comfortable with and asked. In fact, it was only on one occasion I asked not to work on it. And those weren't necessarily for ethical reasons as much as it just kind of touched in an area that I wasn't entirely comfortable with. And, you know, and I said, look, do you mind? And that was absolutely fine. It was the only time that I've ever done it. Otherwise, you just, it's your job and you just get on and do it. So, but as an external publicist, it's nice because I do get to choose what I like to work on. It does mean that, you know, you become very passionate about, you know, what you're doing. And you can choose the nice people that, you know, you get to spend sort of days and weeks on tour with. So,
who are you? Who else are you working with? Or have been lately?
I have worked with all sorts of people. I also work with Tony Kent, who is an up-and-coming crime writer and is currently in the Richard and Judy.
Well, he's kind of
promotion.
Up-and-come?
And up-and-come, actually. Well, I mean, this is the thing. I think, you know, this is only his second book, so...
Writing his fourth one, I think.
Tony is always working for the net. You know, he is brilliant. I mean, he's just such a, you know, he's you know, one of the UK's leading criminal barristers, hugely successful in that area of his life. He was a professional boxer as well, and now he's decided to write crime novels. And
so somebody like him must be a dream for you. I mean, he's a very nice guy, and I've met him and interviewed him, and I like his books. They're very good. I recommend them. Killer Intent was the first one.
Yes.
And the second one is just coming
Marked
out.
For Death.
Marked for Death. And so apart from being very affable and having good work, he's done all sorts of funny things.
Yeah.
Like he was even in Gladiator, I think, as an extra or something like
he's,
that.
Honestly, it is actually a publicist dream working with Tony. He is a really nice guy and he's very funny.
I suppose you want people who you can say, oh, and here's an interesting backstory or here are extra quirky things or...
And there's so few people actually have that many strings to their bow. I mean, that's the thing. It's just kind of extraordinary to have someone who has done so many things and has, you know, been a boxer, has come from, you know, a working class background, has, you know, a brother who spent some time in prison, you know, and he came to the law by watching his brother being represented in court by a barrister who was so brilliant that, you know, the case was thrown out. And he decided that's what he wanted to do with his life. Those kind of authors really don't fall into your lap very often, but it did mean that when we worked on the first book together, it was just incredible how many people were interested in him as a personality. And in some ways, the book is second to that, but it's a very good book. And actually, it's such a good book that it was optioned very, very quickly by Liberty Films, which is Duncan Jones' film company. And it's currently, they're working on sort of casting and that's kind of going ahead very nicely. And, you know, so it's that lovely combination of a good book, a really nice author, but with a fantastic backstory. So that, you know, is a bit of a dream job. A lot of the time, what I do, it doesn't result in anything. You know, it's only about 10% of it actually does manage to get somewhere because there are so many other authors and so many musicians and TV programs and films and, you know, everything that's out looking for a little bit of column inches or sort of airtime and things. And so, you're scrabbling around just kind of looking for coverage, and sometimes you hit it big and you can get BBC Breakfast, or sometimes it's just a case of, look, we've got a really, you know, nice sort of...
Sometimes you're on We'd Like a Word.
Well, no, no, I mean, it, sometimes it's... no, but that's the thing, actually. I think the programmes like this are great because they're really shareable. You know, the internet has transformed what publicists do.
Completely.
And I've, you know, and that's the thing. When I started out, and that's nearly 20 years ago, the internet was a baby back then, and you certainly didn't have things like social media or podcasts or, you know, internet radio. You know, trying to get sort of airtime for your authors was almost impossible, whereas actually there are lots of, I mean, great podcasts, really good programmes, blogs, lots of websites and fanzines that are now online where they used to be printed. But actually it reaches not just a UK market, but actually it becomes shareable and it reaches an international market. So these are really, really important tools.
Well, mention of the internet leads me to the first question. I should say I threw this out on social media to a few writers' groups, mm-hmm. and a few readers' groups as well, and book bloggers, things like that, to try and get some questions. It was flooded. It was an absolute avalanche of questions. But I've tried to break them down. A lot of them were very samey, yeah. A lot of the questions. But I've tried to the first one, one of the strongest ones that came through was, why do we have publicists being paid money to advertise books by authors who are already immensely successful and are probably going to sell millions of copies anyway, when there's hundreds of thousands of other authors there who just need that kind of exposure? Someone was talking about the fact, you know, why do we need to see a poster on a wall for a new J.K. Rowling book? Because people are going to queue around the block to buy it anyway. And it's an interesting question, you know, why do publishers spend their budgets on these people who are already massively successful and are going to sell books anyway, when they've got probably a stable of people who could do with that kind of exposure?
It's not to say that those people don't have exposure through publicity. Marketing is a different area. That's what I would say. And it's interesting because I think a lot of authors and agents and various other people do confuse the two things. So my very simple way of explaining sort of marketing versus publicity is that you pay for marketing. So that's advertising, you know, it's the above the line stuff, but it's sales promotions, things that you have to pay for in bookshops. And whereas publicity, it's more about pitching to media and trying to get review coverage and setting up events and things. So authors, no matter sort of what area they're in, usually will get a publicity campaign. Now, frankly, it's down to the media, whether they're interested in your author. And I have to say, not everyone is as interesting as Tony. But I have worked with really, really huge names in fiction, internationally renowned authors, as well as debuts, and so people like Ian Rankin, Harlan Coben, Anthony Horowitz, and the media is always interested in the very, very big names.
Of course, yes.
Of course, and because it makes sense, because actually those are the names that, you know, their audiences recognise.
Exactly.
What you have to do is actually find a story for the smaller names to make sure that, you know, you're trying to introduce those people to audiences, and the audiences might be small to begin with, but the idea is that you work with that author, hopefully over a period of time, to then continue to build their audience, introduce them to new readers, and at some point, if they have their breakthrough book, or even if their debut is their breakthrough book, then, you know, you are reaching as many people as you possibly can, you know. No publisher, and this is really important to remember, if you are traditionally published, no publisher will buy a book thinking that they're not going to make it as successful as it can be. That would be a waste of everyone's time and money and the resources that are put into publishing a book. Now, sometimes it just doesn't work out the way people would hope, but it doesn't mean that publishers aren't committed to that author when they first buy them, or believe that maybe further down the line they've got a really, really good book with them. And famously, Ian Rankin was published for 8 books before his breakout book, which was Black and Blue. I'm now working with Anne Cleves, and Anne was saying today she had 20 books published before Raven Black, which is her first Shetland novel, and then became a TV series. But she was what is called a mid-list author by the industry, where, you know, they sell at a certain level. They, you know, will do a lot of hard work to reach their audiences, and, you know, it can be a slog. The huge successes, financial or otherwise, can come later. For Anne, it came through Raven Black, which was awarded the Gold Dagger and became a television series. But it took a long time for her to break through, and that can happen. And as long as, you know, if you have the confidence of your publisher who will stick by you, that's fantastic. Mm. Not everyone does.
No, it's a... I mean, the whole landscape of publishing has changed a lot in the last few years. And you were talking earlier about knowing the market. There are all sorts of publishers. I mean, Paul and I have both done books with Unbound, for example. Mm-hmm. And Unbound has a gatekeeper, you know, in the same way that all publishers do, that you send in a manuscript or a sort of synopsis, and if they like it, they say, yeah, we like this, we'll take a punt on it, or they'll say, good luck placing it elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But because then you move into a crowdfunding element,
yes,
and then once the crowdfunding level's been reached, it then switches back to traditional publishing. That's when you start getting the sort of publicity part of it. But because they're fairly new, there's not a lot of money in the tank for publicity. And that leads me to a question that came in, a quite specific question from Stephanie Bretherton, who says, I'd love to know what they consider to be one of the most effective media for sales, national newspapers, radio, live events, or digital media. And honestly, can an unknown debut fiction author actually get their money's worth out of hiring a publicist?
The first part of the question is, what is the most influential? Is it piece of media? Or what I would say is that, you know, the single piece of media that, if you can get on, it will make a difference is BBC Breakfast.
I was going to say TV, isn't it? BBC Breakfast.
Well, it's very specifically BBC Breakfast.
Oh, right, okay.
It's and again, I would say it depends on. So that's for fiction, I would say. Mm. It depends on your audience, and you have to be very selective about who you're putting where. But BBC Breakfast is very well known, sort of in fiction terms, and just being able to reach the right audience who will then go out and buy the book. There are other things like programmes on Radio 2, Radio 5. I mean, Simon Mayo is a fantastic advocate for fiction. And because he's so skilled as an interviewer as well, he really brings a lot of the virtues of a book to the audience. And really, I think his mode of interview means that actually you're really engaging readers and making them want to buy the book. So it's not just about, you know, having X number of listeners or viewers. These are people that actually will go on to then buy the book. Mm-hmm. And one of my, you know, my really sad little sort of hobbies is to check Amazon rankings just after a piece of publicity runs, just to see what the effect is. Mm. So if it's mentioned on, you know, something that Simon's doing, or if it's on BBC Breakfast, within about an hour, you can see the Amazon rankings just going flying right up. Now, in terms
not
of
quite on the same scale, I should say, we did have an email this week from someone who said they bought 5 books as a result of listening to this podcast. Yay!
But that's fantastic.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, that's the thing. It's, you know, I think all, you know, it's always really useful to do publicity of all sorts. You know, it's, I think you have to, you know, spread your net as broadly as possible. What I try to do is actually understand the potential of an author and a book before I will commit to something, because I don't want an author to turn around, you know, 6 months down the line and feel very frustrated. Or that there was no publicity achieved. And that can happen. And it's, every publicist will tell you this, that you can work incredibly hard. It might be a really good story, it might be a really good author, but it's not the right time, it's not the right place. It's just, it doesn't quite work. Maybe there's a legal reason for not being able to talk about a particular story. That's happened to me a couple of times.
Yes,
really
imagine,
good story.
Yeah, yeah.
They just can't cover it. And, you know, there's a lot, you know, there's national broadcast really interested. And all of a sudden it's just like, oh, we can't cover it. It's just, you know, there's an issue about libel or, you know, representing the other side of the story or something. And you just, it's frustrating as a publicist. It must be soul destroying for an
Absolutely.
Author to have invested in you and not to be able to deliver on that investment. So I would prefer to kind of sit down and understand. Now, not everyone's going to do that. I've turned down work because I've just said, look, you know, actually, you have X, Y, and Z. This may or may not happen if I got involved. I think that I'm not sure that I can contribute much more than you've already got in the bag. I'd prefer to be fair with people and to turn down work rather than actually regret it, you know, sort of 6 months later. Mm. And so that's my approach to it. It's not everyone's approach. But I think it's worth, before you commit to anything, have a very frank conversation with a publicist. Ask them to be frank with you. Tell them your expectations, what you would like to come out of it. Ask them what their expectations would be.
They can be quite unrealistic sometimes, can't they? Let's be honest with some people.
Absolutely. And it can be very difficult to kind of, you know, to guide an author through what's genuinely achievable. And sometimes you can achieve so much more than you expect. You know, I mean, going back to the question about, you know, if you're a debut author, is it worth investing? I work, I mentioned him umpteen times before, but with Tony Kent.
Yeah,
Tony was published by a very small independent publisher who'd never worked on fiction before, never mind crime fiction. I wouldn't have expected to have gotten Tony onto BBC Breakfast, Radio 2, Radio 4, Radio 5, BBC World Service. But he had such a unique story that so many people just wanted to speak to him. And, you know, what we achieved in that campaign was much greater than any of us expected. So I think you can achieve a huge amount, but normally you're never going to get that level of coverage,
of course.
You know.
You're listening to We'd Like a Word with me, Paul Waters.
And me, I'm just about to eat a biscuit.
Angela McMahon, who is our guest, she's got a biscuit. I'm going to tell you who she is to give her a bit of time to chew it.
I'm going to go into my jammy dodger while
you're doing it. Okay, so Angela is, the cookie monster is next to me here, is co-director of the Noirland Festival, we'll hear about that in a bit, director of Flow Communications, and she's kind of this fantastic book publicist. But now I am going to have to interrupt your biscuit, Steve. Because we have more questions from listeners.
Yes, we have.
Well, he can hardly speak.
Okay.
Okay, before you do that, it was your birthday recently. Listeners will know that Steve's been going on about it. It's going to be his birthday. It has been his birthday. I finally got your present.
What did you get me?
I got you Professor Moriarty, The Hand of the D'Urbervilles by Kim Newman.
It's kind of a really good
pastiche of a parallel world to Sherlock Holmes and that. And I've read it and it was good. And there are lots of funny little clever references in it. I thought, ooh, that's the sort of thing that you like. And I liked it too. But
do you know
somebody
wrote a really good
Happy
book
birthday.
About Moriarty? Thank you very much. Do you know somebody wrote a really good book about Sherlock Holmes and in the world of Sherlock Holmes? Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Ah.
The American, American basketball player. The guy who was, he was the black guy in the cockpit in an aeroplane. He wrote an amazing book set in, I think it was based around Moriarty again. And it's just,
well, this is like John Watson's equivalent.
Well, Kim Newman's very good at this.
Moriarty's sidekick. And
fantastic.
It's a little bit Flashman-esque, I suppose.
I got a present.
That's good.
We'll put it up on social media and I can show you my lovely new book, all right?
Okay, yeah.
I'm showing it to the microphone.
But anyway, let's have a listener question.
Okay, we've got another question here from Samuel Dodson.
Who says, the author of Philosophy of Dogs.
Oh, Philosophy
like
of Dogs,
that.
That's right, it is, isn't it? Yeah.
He's writing a book about philosophy, but through like Immanuel Kant's dog, that sort of thing.
Oh.
Yeah,
fascinating.
I did some research to back up this question because I was trying to find some recent figures about how many books are being published, and it's really hard to get figures.
Mm.
But the one figure that really jumped out at me, which is quite extraordinary, is the amount of books that are being self-published on Amazon
as
one platform and one way of getting your book out there. And between 2014 and 2018, the total grew from 3 million to 6 million ebooks on Amazon, which means that 250,000 ebooks were published each year between the two dates. What that equates to is one new book entering the Kindle store every 1 minute and 42 seconds. At the moment, there's about 48.5 million books on Amazon. That's the groundswell you're trying to be seen amongst. Only 6 million are ebooks. It's a very small proportion, considering how many are being produced, one every minute, 42 seconds. And Samuel's question is, when everyone and their dog, very appropriately, is selling their book, how do you cut through the noise of social media, the background babble? How do you cut through that and make yours sort of come to the fore?
I also work with Mark Dawson, who is a really interesting author, in fact, because he was traditionally published and he decided after his first couple of books that he would have a go himself, just in the early days of self-publishing. And he experimented and he played around with marketing and, you know, did some Google ads and Facebook ads and things. But he has become, I would say, one of the UK's most successful self-published authors, and
he writes thrillers.
As various different series, mostly set around, you know, sort of UK based, but he, you know, I think that he's really interested in actually sort of what you do to cut through the background noise, because a lot of it is down to marketing and reaching audiences. As far as I'm concerned, it's audiences, audiences, audiences. And once you start engaging those people, it's keeping them engaged and getting them to then recommend you as well. And you can provide additional material. So you write your book and you can give away little bits and pieces. But to stand out, you know, it is, I would not like to be starting out writing now, because it's so difficult. It really is. And there are so many traditionally published books, never mind self-published. And so it's very, very hard. And I think you get the metadata right, you get the buzzwords right, you get the look right, even though it might be a very small image on Amazon. Make sure that actually, remember that it is going to be a small image. Don't, you know, have a book cover that's actually, when it's reduced down, you can't actually make out any of the detail. So think about very straightforward things like that. This is marketing now. This isn't
publishing. I appreciate that.
There was the thing about Mark. I mean, he does quite, he is quite a prodigious output.
Yes.
And I know he recruits people to help with the writing as well now that he's so successful. Mm-hmm. But is it three or maybe even four books a year?
It's certainly four books this year, and he's doing an Audible original, which is coming out at the end of...
So I suppose if you've somebody hooked,
yeah,
and then you've multiple hooks and you're getting them again and again, and if you get somebody on, well, for him, I don't know, book 30 maybe or more, then they might, oh, well, I'll go back to the start. And
yeah.
And so I suppose having a lot on offer...
I worked with MJ Arledge, who's another bestseller, and, you know, Matt Arledge is also a screenwriter. And he, you know, he applied some of the lessons he's learned writing thrillers for television and psychological dramas and things. And it's about actually keeping your audience with you. And so he had decided, you know, two things that he bore in mind when he was starting out his series was that if I publish two books a year, that shelf in Waterstones is going to fill up with my books quite quickly. And so Arledge will be a chunk of books
That's exactly what my agent said to me, because we were having problems placing we were getting stuff back from publishers saying, very good, well, very well written, very funny, just not the market at the moment because we're not publishing a lot of comedy novels. Because comedy's got a bit of a downer at the moment for some reason in fiction. But I said, well, what about if I do it through Unbound or something? You won't get anything out of it. My agent, to his credit, said, I don't care. Get more books out there with your name on it. You know, people will see a bookshelf that's got Colgan, 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 Colgan. And I think he's got a point there. You know, that saturation thing.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, you know, in addition to sort of the physical space, it's just that if you've hooked someone in with one book, they, you know, they're desperate to read the next book in the series. That's the thing. It's about the addictive quality. And if you're launching a series, it's different if it's a standalone. But if you want to launch a series, come swiftly in with the next book, I'd say. You know, try and get it out as quickly as possible. Or if it's a book the following year, bring out something like a short story, a novella, something like that. Just keep your audience with you. And I've seen with so many authors who are really, really good and actually best-selling authors, international bestsellers, who might have a break of 2 or 3 years or 7 years. And suddenly, when they come back again, people are going, oh, yeah,
they're
what was that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what was that book about? I do remember.
Going back to MJ Arledge, Matt Arledge. So he has a nice little bit of backstory, which probably you told me.
Quite possibly.
So his father was a judge, was it?
Or a barrister.
A barrister.
Yeah.
And tell us about that.
So Matt's father is a very well-known QC who has represented all sorts of interesting people. So Matt, growing up, him and his sisters would kind of steal into his father's study to kind of look at crime scene photographs.
I used to do that as a kid. My dad was a homicide detective.
Yeah, and that's the thing.
I used to do exactly the same thing.
And that's we love that adrenaline buzz of seeing
horrible.
Yeah. No. So now what's funny is he then started working in, in EastEnders when he became a scriptwriter, and Hamish Macbeth, I think it was something like along those lines. So he's had a long sort of screen career as well. And when he first, he started working on Silent Witness, and his kids now, they play crime scene on a Saturday morning with him. And so they'll get the sort of beetroot juice and pour it on the kitchen floor.
Of course they do.
And so it's great because they love going on to set with him, and just it's so exciting. And then they have the rubber gloves on and the sandwich bags to put the evidence into, because
fantastic.
You know, that's what dad's job is, and it's so much fun. The kids are so dark.
They are, I know. Yeah. I was reading an interview at the weekend with Nicola May, mm-hmm. who had a big success in January with The Corner Shop in Cocklebury Bay.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this is a self-published author, mm-hmm. again. And what came out very strongly for me was there was one little paragraph in the interview where I was thinking, wow, she's done well. And then it says, I come from a strong marketing and creative background. I'm quite feisty. And that really struck me at the time, because an awful lot of authors I meet are very introverted, and they find it quite difficult. I mean, some people can get up on a stage and they can talk in front of people. Some people are quite good at pushing themselves out there, but there's an awful lot of writers who are quite introverted, quite quiet. How can they get noticed? I mean, obviously they can hire a publicist, but otherwise, is there any other way they can get noticed? I suppose social media helps a bit.
I think if you're good at social media, but a lot of people find it actually not a very comfortable medium for them either. So unless they feel comfortable doing it, it can come across as quite artificial.
Because the whole thing is, people say, I want to write. I like to write.
Mm.
It's the job most people want to do. When they do surveys, people say, what would be your dream job? People say, a writer.
But they don't want to promote themselves or do trivial things on social media.
Want to write.
Yeah.
And they might not be able to, and they don't want to. And I suppose you say, yeah, well, you're tough luck, you just have to.
I mean, see there's a part of me that thinks, well, if you're doing work in your house, unless you're very competent and very confident to do your own plumbing, you have to bring in a professional to do that. So, I mean, is that a good analogy here? Is that you're not competent enough to publicise yourself, you should bring in a publicist?
I think if you have the resources to bring in a publicist...
I can't imagine it's cheap, but I'm not going to obviously tie it in price, but I'm saying I can't imagine it's available to everyone's means.
No.
To do
I think even if it was, £100 or something to have someone working with you, it's still going to be beyond certain people as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. You have to appreciate, actually, it's going to be an investment. And it isn't going to be available to everyone. So, I would say that actually a lot of the authors that I've worked with, they said themselves, they spend so much of their time alone writing or they're observers of people and they're not particularly comfortable going out and selling themselves. And so they rely on either other people to do that for them, whether that's people that they've hired in or their publishers, if they're traditionally published, have hired or work for them.
But if they hire you, presumably you turn around and say, so let's have all interesting things to talk about and, you know, be nice and outgoing when I introduce you to people. Yeah.
Well, it's,
I
mean, but I've also worked with, you know, authors who are incredibly shy and really anxious about doing broadcast. And I would spend a lot of time working with them on doing media skills and sort of how to talk comfortably.
When to have a biscuit.
Have still water, not sparkling
water. Oh, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely,
that's
definitely
another trick.
No belch.
We've all had the burpee interview. Yeah,
I know. Yeah. Don't have anything spicy before you go on.
I've got one more question I'm going to throw at you, and then we'll talk about Noirland and some of the other things you're involved in. And this one came in from Ollie Jacobs. I think it was my favourite question, which was, what's the most obscure word you've ever used to promote a book?
I would say that if you're using obscure words, then you're not promoting.
Oh, she's avoiding the question.
However, and I was thinking, what is the, probably, and it's not that obscure, microcosm. And it's not obscure.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, it's a nice word, but, you know, it's...
It makes me think of last week's programme, or the programme before last. A recent programme, anyway.
Makes
me think of Dr. Erica McAllister and The Secret Life of Flies, microcosm.
Yes, indeed, yes. That was an interesting discussion.
That was very funny. Okay, so microcosm. What else have we got to ask?
Good word. No, that's all the questions.
I know. Well, what are you reading? That's what I was going to ask you. What are you reading? Do you ever get a chance to actually read for fun? So presumably you've been reading Anne Cleves.
I have.
Because you've just been working with her.
Because
and that's fun too. I'm not saying it isn't, but that's for work.
Yeah.
So what are you actually going to read next?
I am going to read, you might have, you know, heard in my accent that, like Paul, I'm from Northern Ireland, and I am about to read a non-fiction book on the border and the history of the border.
Because very much in the news at the
moment. Indeed, yes, and I think that's why.
What's it called?
And it's actually called The Border, but it's The Border in Northern Ireland it's talking about by
Dermot Ferriter.
Yeah. Yes, well remembered.
See, I thought you were going to talk about Brian McGilloway, because he has a book, Borderlands.
Yes.
And his books are all set in the border, kind of Derry, Strabane, Donegal. Sort of thing, and he's got another one coming out.
He's got a book coming out next March, which I have been very fortunate to have a PDF of. Brian sent it to me.
Have you read it?
No, I read the first page actually, because it literally arrived about 10 minutes after he also sent me a PDF of Anne Cleves' book. I have literally only been working with Anne for a few weeks, so I read it and I started to read a different book for another work project, and I've now finished Anne's book.
See, imagine a book publicist who gets to read for work, but then I don't have any time. Well, not much time, I suppose. You've got a wee bit of time. Do you know, we talked a bit about Noirland. Steve was talking about Noirland earlier.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know, it's a crime fiction festival that happens in Belfast. So noir, crime fiction, and no Ireland, or no Ireland, who knows. And it happens in Belfast, and you're one of the organisers. Some people would say the organiser. But a bit of politely.
There's usually
else.
One. If you've got a team of organisers, there's usually one person who's done it.
And it's happened twice. I was at the last one in March 2019. Tell us a bit about that and how crazy it must be to put on something like that.
Yeah, it is crazy. And you have to be crazy to do it. We decided, myself and a friend, David Torrance, who is the owner of No Alibis Bookshop in Belfast.
That's my favourite bookshop.
It is
No Alibis on Botanic Avenue.
I know, it's fantastic. Yeah.
You get free cups of tea.
I know, we talked about it in a previous episode.
And an odd biscuit occasionally, and a warm hug on your... Not everyone gets a warm hug. I get a warm hug on arrival, but, you know, you get
sort
a warm
hugs
smile.
Out. We've got the biscuits. We can sort out some hugs later. That's
it's nice. I was asking somebody... So on this programme we had Anthony Horowitz.
Mm-hmm.
And either the morning, the day beforehand, or the morning of that day when I was going to interview him, I thought, I'll just ask random people in No Alibi's shop. And there was this random bloke, so I said, oh, if you're going to, you know, ask Anthony Horowitz a question, what would you ask him? It turned out he was American. And he said, oh, well, where do you get your ideas? And I thought, that's a rubbish question. And then he could tell. He said, oh, I'm just in really to see if they have my books here. So it turned out he's a writer from Alan Drew from America, who we'll feature on this at some point. And they did. They had two stacks of his books. And they'd loads of them. And so I thought, I will save the situation. Shall we go up to the back of the shop and do an interview? So I did. So it's that sort of shop. It was a quiet day there.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of podcast.
It's slightly random accosting strangers in bookshops.
Yeah, so you can look forward to that on a future episode. Yeah. Well, tell us about the scale of Noirland and that.
So we decided to have a crime fiction festival in Belfast, and Ireland didn't have one at that point of any description, not a regular one. They've had smaller things and things that have popped up for 1 year and, you know, maybe disappeared again. So we wanted to bring what I think the UK has done extremely well in Harrogate and Bloody Scotland and various other crime festivals.
I hasten to add, Bloody Scotland is the official title of the festival.
It is. Great festival.
It's a great festival. And that's the thing. I think we wanted to do something that in many ways imitated Bloody Scotland and feeling very distinctly Irish, as it does Scottish, but making it an international festival where we would bring authors from across the UK, Europe, America, wherever, and bringing them to Ireland, to Belfast, to show really the influence on international crime writing on local authors, but also to show the incredible range of authors that Ireland is currently producing. And so we came up with this concept of Noirland, and very much focused on it being an international crime writing festival in Belfast, but with a very distinctly Irish accent, as we like to think of it.
And there are a lot of women there, because I remember it started...
Well, it's crime, isn't it? They write all the best crime books, and they read a lot of crime books.
A lot of women writers, and women, like all women at
events and stuff. It's because they're crafty.
What was interesting, actually, was because we weren't particularly... We didn't go in going, right, OK, we need to have 50% this and 50% that and tick all of these boxes. We went in wanting to have interesting writers talking about interesting topics, and that was the heart of it. We knew that in Belfast and in Ireland, there was a great appetite for conversation and for having meaty discussions. And so the idea was that we would come up with strong topics and have an Irish author to represent an Irish perspective, but actually mix that in with people from all sorts of different backgrounds. So we came up with a good concept and then spoke to a lot of publishers and different people. And, you know, I've spent 15 years working in crime fiction, so I know a lot of people, I've been to a lot of events, I know what works and what doesn't work. And I also recognise, actually, having spent a lot of time with authors over the last few years, is actually what they enjoy doing and what they enjoy talking about.
Well, you are one of these authors who goes to book festivals.
Well, when I'm invited, yeah.
Well, what do you enjoy about it then?
I mean, the interaction with the audience is always great. I love the interaction with the audience, and it's... And it's nice. The other thing I really like doing is sitting on panels where you're discussing with a group of other authors a particular subject. One of the panels that was set up for Bradford recently was all about countryside with a sea. all about stories that are set within the country. It was sort of looking at the sort of...
Like countryside is in Homicide.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, right. I mean, okay. It was sort of building on... It was actually more to do than that. It was about writing rural books because mine are all set in a fictitious county, but there's murder that happens. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of, you know, what happens when Stella Gibbons meets Agatha Christie sort of thing. And I love sitting on panels. Panels is tremendous fun.
And that's the thing, but I think, you know, for a lot of authors, they've done many, many panels where it's very similar topics and they're saying kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
And what we wanted to do was, and in fact, our first Noirland, we had a panel on crime fiction in the countryside, and it was subtitles "The Cultures Are Coming," which is
so culture is a kind of a derogatory term for people who live in the countryside in Ireland.
Indeed. And as a semi-culture myself, I was proud to support that title. But the idea was that actually, and I'm assuming from the title of the book that you're a Sherlock Holmes fan.
I do like Sherlock Holmes. I'm quite fond of Conan Doyle.
And yes. And that's the thing. It's the Conan Doyle. Well, Sherlock Holmes famously said that that the countryside is a much darker place than the city.
Very much so. Yeah.
And that's the idea. It was what does the countryside bring to crime fiction? We hear about these dark, mean streets, but actually, there is a dynamic within the countryside that is very
dark
different.
Lanes are much worse. Dark Absolutely. Dark country lanes are much worse.
And secrets, and that's the thing. It's the secrets of the countryside, and it's how, and smaller communities, because, again, talking to Anne Cleves earlier today, she was talking about sort of the Shetland community and the fact that there are 28,000 people across the islands, and everyone knows everybody else.
And so any one of them could be a murderer.
Well, it's
something
it's all
nasty in the woodshed.
Indeed, but they might know the history of, someone and not talk about it. So one of the suspicious characters in Raven Black, the first book in her Shetland series, I think had a very nasty childhood and a bullying mother and no one talked about it. Everyone knew, but no one talked about it. And so it's the secrets that smaller communities keep because...
Well, that makes me think of Will Dean and his...
Yeah,
To the Moodyson books.
Yeah.
Or even Graham Norton, who we had on show number two, with his dark secrets in little Irish communities and things like that.
But if you're doing a panel, and as you're saying, the risk is people think, oh, here we go again.
Yeah.
And it might be with the same people on the panel. I mean, have you had times when it's gone deliciously wrong? Or people don't get on, or somebody has just had too much alcohol that just goes completely off.
It hasn't happened to me yet, but
you've got a big intake capacity.
I didn't mean the alcohol, but I mean I haven't had a panel go wrong.
To be fair, I think when you work in crime fiction, you assume that either someone is going to be incredibly hungover or that they might have several drinks taken before they go on to a panel. It's kind of it's par for the course with crime writing. Nothing's gone horribly wrong, thank God. I would say you might start off with a concept that you think a conversation's going to take a particular direction and it doesn't. But I think what we tend to do is actually sort of brief the host of the panel, or the moderator, as we call them, who then understands why you've selected these particular authors. If you give them a meaty topic, what you're there to do is not to guide them and give them sort of very precise areas that they're to talk about, but it's actually to throw something interesting at them and then wait for them to come back. And the reason that you have chosen these authors is because they do have something to contribute to a discussion. And what's been lovely is that the feedback from both authors and our audiences has been incredible. They love the topics. They love the meatiness of the topics. And people come back and, again and again, just because they've really enjoyed the discussion. And we've had authors compare us very favourably to incredibly well-known festivals, nationally, internationally known festivals, because the topics are well thought out. And we've got good moderators. And
sometimes funny, some the odd time, you say a moderator or somebody who's interviewing somebody, and they're quite nervous.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because they think, oh, my gosh, I'm on stage with this really well-known writer. Maybe a writer who they admire and have admired for years.
Mm.
And that you see them going, oh, no. But it's always nice in those circumstances because the more well-known person is very generous.
Yes. Yeah.
But I say about the audience participation, I think the best question I ever got asked by a member of the public was by an audience member was, it was at Harrogate a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew I'd spent 30 years working as a real police officer. And they said to me, well, as a police officer with all this experience, could you murder someone and get away with it? And I sat there and I said, yeah.
And you said,
what do you mean, again? But one of the things that came up, we were talking about rural just now, one of the things, because cops do sit around on, well, they used to back in the day, whether they've got time now, I don't know, because they run ragged now, but back in the day, we used to sit around on a night duty in a canteen, when it's a little bit quiet, 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and you discuss things. And a game we used to play quite often was Perfect Murder. Could you get away with a crime? And one of them was precisely using the rural community, because I'll give you a great example. I went to the Outer Hebrides this time last year. I was in the Outer Hebrides, and we booked this little cottage right down the far end of Harris, where our nearest neighbour was about 2.5 miles away, and obviously booked it in a name, but there's nothing written down at how many there were in our party. And you could have taken someone along, killed them, buried them on the moor there, or chucked them in the sea. No one would ever know. Because there's no witnesses,
no one ever
walks around there. It's just only the people who would stay in this one little holiday cottage. And they're not necessarily going to go out and see if there's any bodies buried, because you just never know.
Yeah. Dogs, though.
Dogs, maybe.
Let's have a sniff.
But then again, you get the body into the sea, you know, there's plenty of things to deal with that body for you. Crabs and seagulls and God knows what else.
All of a sudden the walls are closing in on me in this small
room. But I mean, trust me, I can give you at least 10 different ways where you could murder someone and get away with it. It's quite scary, really.
Yeah, and actually...
thankfully, most people are good.
Well, that's the thing.
99% of people are good.
And the people that don't get away with it aren't... Well, I've been told, and you might be able to verify this, but... having spoken to sort of barristers and policemen and et cetera over the years and been to lots of events, that, you know, most murders are carried out in domestic circumstances, but actually not by particularly
they're not
brilliant
people. Generally, murderers aren't very bright. And they're certainly not very charismatic either. They're rather dull people sometimes as well.
Yeah, that's Denise Miner.
Denise Miner, she's been on a previous show and she said,
and I worked with Denise.
You've worked with everybody.
Lovely lady.
She is fantastic.
So she's saying, why focus on all this stuff on the murderers, these criminal masterminds? Nah, they're boring, inadequate, rubbish people. What about the wonderful people who they kill?
And, you know, thanks to her, I bought a book. Because I went out and bought a copy of Hallie Reuben Holds the Five. The book about the Jack Ripper's victims.
Yes.
And it's a staggeringly brilliant book.
Sorry, Denise, it wasn't your book he went on.
And actually...
No, but I tell you, I think we should try and get Hallie on the show.
Yeah.
She lives in London. I know someone who knows her.
Yeah, so. And I can put you in touch with the publisher. Ooh, in fact, I wanted... But again, actually, we did a panel on victims because I was really interested in the idea
of... It's much more interesting.
Yeah, but actually, a lot of victims aren't simply the evidence.
No,
that's
of course
the
not.
Thing. And that's
a good way of putting it, not just the evidence.
And there are a lot of crime writers who want to put them, you know, to the forefront of their crime novel and actually get you to focus on them. And I think that's a really interesting idea.
Do you think that women are in the vanguard of that change of approach?
You know, I think that a lot of women crime writers are interested in the psychology and whether they're getting inside the victim's head, the hero's head, or even the villain's head. I think women are interested in what makes people tick, but actually I think if you're writing fiction, I think you have to have an interest in human nature generally, and I don't see it as being one sex or another. I think people are just, writers are interested in people and psychology, and I read somewhere a couple of years back, people were talking about sort of the more fiction you read, the more empathetic you are as a human being. And I think it's really important to
actually... I must be very, very empathetic then.
I'm getting that way. I'm reading a lot more fiction than I used to. I used to read a lot of non-fiction. But...
Although The Secret Life of Flies has, you know, hardened me again.
Yeah, but you know a lot about flies now.
Yeah.
Now you're very sympathetic towards flies.
That's it. I've gone off empathy to humans and onto flies.
But, of course, flies also relate very strongly to forensics and things like this.
Indeed.
As well.
Yes, and indeed. There's no flies on you.
That was Erica McAllister finding a body under the bed because a blue bottle alerted her to its presence. I think it was a dead mouse.
It was, Her cat is a horror. It's like a suburban tiger.
I wonder, we're coming near the end, I think. We sometimes have a competition.
Or at least a teaser of the week.
Exactly. So we're kind of moving away from competitions because we've been a bit rubbish in sending out prizes.
No, whoops.
But
you're keeping the prizes.
Generally. No, of course not. No.
But so what would be an interesting question to ask listeners that kind of derived from people you've worked with, things you've done?
Well, while you think of that, what about giving the answer to Erica McAllister's question?
Oh, yes. I know the answer.
From her show.
What was the question?
What's the most diverse
animal.
The most diverse group of animals and habitats
that.
We know it's a fly. What sort of fly?
Come on, you're asking me to be specific now.
It was Phorids.
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 Also known as?
Forids.
Horrid. Also known as horrid forids.
Because they're in all environments and they do lots of different specialisms and different jobs. Forids are the most diverse in terms of where they live and what they do of any group of animals.
There you go. So well done to everyone who got that, not including me.
Right, we come back to you now.
Oh dear, pressure. Yeah. So you want me to come up with
some sort of question.
Just a little question to get people going away and doing a bit of research or finding the answer.
Okay. So one of the authors that I worked with for a long time was Ian Rankin.
Ian Rankin,
man.
All good.
And Ian introduced a new character into his books quite recently in the last 3 books. Rebus now has a dog. What's the name of Rebus's dog?
It's quite sick, because then he has to keep going out for walks and spotting people carrying out surveillance, or it's an excuse to walk past people's houses.
Good excuse to go to the pub as well.
Yeah.
As long as, that's the problem. As long as the Oxford Bar allows dogs in.
Well, exactly,
that's a
yeah.
very good question. Does the Ox allow dogs?
Probably they'd allow his dog, I suspect.
Yeah.
So what is the name of John Rebus's dog?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So if you know the answer to that and you want to join in, you can email your answer to weedlikeaword@gmail.com. Although, of course, because we're not allowed to use apostrophes in social media things, it's wedlikeaword@gmail.com. We really didn't think about this, did we, when we created the name of the show?
Wedlikeaword@gmail.com.
Indeed, yeah.
And the social media, it's also wedlikeaword or @wedlikeaword on Facebook and Twitter.
It is indeed. Although don't put your answer on there, because then you're telling everyone the answer. Better.
Yeah, idea. Yeah, you're right. Ignore what I just said. Just email us.
But if you ever want to talk about us, what am I trying to say?
He's been drinking again.
If you ever want to contact us to have a chat about books or to suggest topics we can cover in the future, then yeah, do get in contact by Twitter, Facebook, email,
or if you've been
pigeon toast, whatever you choose
to read something, to try something new, something you heard here, let us know.
Indeedy.
So. Thank you very much indeed, Angela McMahon.
Great to be here.
If you need to be publicised and you can afford it, feels like the A-Team. It feels like the A-Team. If you need help and you can find them, hire the A-Team. Angela McMahon.
They're showing those on TV again at the moment.
I know.
Oh, they're so dated, aren't they? And I just love the fact it's so formulaic, isn't it? Every show, they you know, Matey will turn up, Hannibal Smith will turn up in a weird outfit to meet the person who needs their help. And then they'll have a meet-up, their first showdown with the bad guys, and there'll always be a bar fight where Mr. T throws someone over a bar, and then they'll come up with a plan. Then they get locked in a shed, and they build a tank out of...
And then they shoot all these people and miss...
That's right, they're spraying people with machine gun fire, and there's no blood, no bullets, no one dies.
Because also, you also have to have BA being
I'm not
drugged...
I'm no plane.
I know, drugged to go onto a plane.
Absolutely.
And Hannibal saying something, you know, I love it when the plan comes together.
Oh, and Mad Murdoch's got to escape from the psychiatric hospital and have some weird idiosyncrasy that day, like he believes he's a dog or an Indian Raja or something.
Yes, and and Face has to have a point where he falls in love with a beautiful woman.
Of course.
Yeah.
See, you don't need to watch it now. That's every episode of the A-Team.
It's what we model our programme on.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I'm Highland Mad Murdoch.
Yeah, which one am I then?
Hannibal.
And we'll leave it there. We'll draw away. We're not.
I love it when a podcast comes together.
Exactly. And this has been Weed Like a Word with me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colvin.
Until the next time.
Bye bye.